NowVeryBad.com presents Now Very Beast, Iron Maiden, The Next 10 Years. Host Michael Ford Feeney. Hey there, and welcome to episode 1 of Now Very Beast, Iron Maiden, The Next 10 Years. We finally got here. It's finally time to stop planning the show, actually hit record. There's nothing really all that odd about this delay, about how long it took me to get to this point, to stop obsessively tinkering with every detail and every plan and just to start. It's in perfect keeping with the inspiration for this show and the man it's a tribute to. There's one characteristic that every band I was in with my friend Basher shared. It was that nothing was ever good enough to go. Nothing was ever ready enough to go. You know, we would never let the temptation of actually accomplishing something get in the way of our stubborn insistence on arguing over minutiae. You know, we never really got out of the basement because we were so busy making sure that everything was exactly how we wanted it. We probably should have named our band The Enemy of Good because we were always after perfection and, you know, whatever. I still struggle with it. Maybe with this show, I'll finally get over some of that and things will be good enough to get rolling. But this episode in particular did actually take a long time, not because I was being so neurotic, but because there really is actually a lot to talk about with the first release of this series. You know, the first 10 years, part one, contains Running Free and Sanctuary, their first two singles. And there's a lot on here. You know, more than one time, I sort of debated just kind of skipping over this one and starting off with number two or three first. I'm still not sure that I shouldn't have done that just to get some momentum going, because either of these singles for me could warrant their own episode. You know, you get into all kinds of stuff about why are there non-album singles? What's that about? Why are the English tend to prefer the non-album singles, and you know, how's that different with what the album-oriented focus would be in the States or things like that. And Sanctuary itself, just about the whole thing about songwriting credits and publishing, you know, it's a whole hornet's nest. So maybe I'll get back to that sort of stuff. You know, if anybody else in the world is interested or as nerdy about it as I am, and Maiden fans are, maybe I'll get back to it. But for right now, let's just get started and let's dive right into the first 10 years, part one. Running Free and Sanctuary, released February 12th, 1990, reached chart position of number 10 on the UK albums chart, which is where they needed to be because this was, you know, six tracks long, including that Listen with Nico part one track, which was 9 minutes plus, almost 10 minutes just by itself. But a great release. It's not surprising that it would go all the way to number 10, because a lot of people probably did not have these original singles. So this really was a very exciting release. We've got here is Running Free with its original B-side, Burning Ambition. Let's talk about Steve Harris's first track. And then Sanctuary, backed with Drifter and I've Got the Fire, and the Montrose cover. Two live tracks recorded in 1980 at the Marquee. That was pretty cool to have two B-sides on a 7-inch record, because these both were 7 inches. So let's just dive right into this with the first single, Running Free. Iron Maiden's first single, February 8th, 1980. Made it to position number 34 on the UK singles chart, which is pretty impressive with no radio play. And they're not exactly an independent band, but not really heavily promoted at that point either. Running Free was recorded at Kingsway Studios in London, February 13th through February 29th of 1980 was when they were in the studio to record the debut album. They were doing their sessions for the record, the self-titled debut that would come out on April 6th of that same year. This one was not one of the first entries I got in the first 10 years series. It was pretty far down the line, actually, that I think I picked this one up. Sometimes I couldn't be choosy. I couldn't find these things, and it was just luck or happenstance. But I don't think I would have dived right for this one anyway, because I knew this debut album cold. And having five new songs here, two of which I already had on the debut album, wouldn't have been a big draw for me compared with some of the others where I was seeing things I'd never seen before. But honestly, this has come to be one of my favorite releases in the whole series, just because of the B-sides. B-sides are phenomenal. I mean, it's not that I don't love Running Free. It's just I don't have a lot to say about it. I mean, it's Running Free. You know the song very, very well. They played the song live for years. Too many years, in my opinion. I mean, I hope I never hear this song live again, honestly. Which I shouldn't really complain about. Honestly, when I was doing a little bit of research on this, I realized I actually never saw them play this song. In any of the shows that I've gone to see, they've never done it. It's just from all the live albums and all the concerts I'd seen over the years, they'd always play this. And again, it's not that I don't like the tune or anything. It's just, particularly when you're on Live After Death, they're playing these really complicated numbers. And then they go back and play Running Free. And you're sort of like, guys, you're slumming here a little bit. This just feels very basic. It's very simplistic compared to some of these other more complicated tunes that you're doing now. But maybe because it's not in these set lists anymore, I've really started to love this song. It's really, I can't say grown on me, because I certainly loved it on the first album, and I got the first album pretty early on, and always enjoyed it. But now, every time I'll go to put something on and you get that opening drum bit, you know, that's pretty much Gary Glitter's Rock and Roll Part One, you know, like dump 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 dump. It's just so good. It's just so fun. And it's not actually the song entirely. It's a lot about it is the production, which is a very interesting sort of insight as I realized that I love the production, because so often you hear the production about the debut album really denigrated, that it's a lot of people say, oh, it's just, it's weak. You know, they had this producer, Will Malone, that more or less just sort of sat back there and read the paper and didn't really take much of an interest in what they were doing. And it certainly is undercooked in some ways. It's a bit raw, but beginning to really understand why some people still think it's their best album, because that rawness is very much attributable to what you would have heard if you saw them live at that time. And there's a real charm to it, you know, that I just think it really sells itself. It doesn't sound like the other records, but that's not a bad thing. It's very, very, very different. Now, John, my friend, I would have to argue with him about this all the time, because it was really funny that I could never quite understand how he could say that this was his favorite band and he refused, stoutfastedly just refused to listen to the first two albums. Anything without Bruce Dickinson as the lead singer, he didn't want to listen to. And I said, you know, that's just kind of dumb. You're missing out. You know, it's very different. I mean, in the first album, it's almost like an entirely different band, but it's really good stuff. And I think you're selling yourself short if you don't go for it, because there's this great vibe to Running Free. And you know what? It's short. Short songs, guys, you might want to look into that. You know, everything doesn't need to be 8 minutes long. That's all I'm saying. But the B-side for Running Free was a song called Burning Ambition. It's very appropriate that this would be the backing track on this single. They recorded this at Wessex Studios in London on November 26th, 1979, and at that same session, they recorded a demo of Running Free. Now, this is not the version that appears on the record. However, it accidentally made its way onto the German 7-inch single and the French 7-inch single. And they did this compilation for KTEL Records. I mean, really, actually, KTEL Records, for anybody from any of those 80s kids who would hear those really cheesy ads about KTEL Records releases. Yep. They had one called Axe Attack in 1980. And they put this demo version on by mistake, and nobody noticed. So it must have been fairly a good cut. You know, I've heard it. It's not bad. It certainly isn't as good as the single, but it's not a bad cut. But at that same session, they did Burning Ambition. And it's nearly perfect as a backing track for the first single, because you're already hearing something you've never heard before from them, and you're never going to hear it again. This is the first song, the first proper song completely written by Steve Harris. He wrote a couple other things. He had written this song called Alternatively, The Pit. It's referred to as Endless Pit. And later that would turn into Innocence Exile, and then finally Innocent Exile later. But that really wasn't totally finished. This was the first tune that was finished. He played this in his very first band called Gypsy's Kiss. They played about 5 gigs before they were done, and then he started a band or joined a band called Smiler, which was more of a boogie band. Nico talks about this on his Not a Lot of People Know That track. I'm not totally sure which one he's talking about. I mean, he's talking about Gypsy's Kiss. He makes all these jokes about their name and sort of attributes to them. But really, I've sort of heard the story both ways, that this boogie band couldn't really be bothered to learn any of Harris's stuff either. The bottom line is both bands were inequipped to deal with the time changes and the complexity of the stuff that Harris was writing, and would have to form his own band, Iron Maiden, in order to carry out. But I love this song. From the very first time I heard this song, I absolutely loved it. It's totally different than all the stuff that they're going to do later. Not only does it not sound like Iron Maiden, it doesn't even sound like that first Iron Maiden album particularly, that was done at about the same time. But it's got this really neat feel to it. I mean, there's this great energy to it, and it sounds like nothing else. And it's clear that this is something that he really had put a lot of himself into. You know, it's your first glimpse into the very, very early origins of what will become Iron Maiden. All the things are there. Everything that you're going to know and love about Harris's writing, it's all there in that first track, but it sounds almost more like classic rock than it does metal or anything. But one of the interesting things about that, again, coming back to the sound, it's got wonderful tone. You know, the guitars, the bass. Later, Harry's going to get really into the clackety with his bass, you know, which I love. You know, it's synonymous with Steve Harris, is the clack, 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 clack. And it's fantastic. But it also sort of was the tail wagging the dog after a while. You know, by the time you get to the late 80s, you know, when he's now taking over everything and saying, oh, I should be able to produce these albums and, you know, do like the Made in England, or he produced a live record. Sounds absolutely awful. You know, I mean, you can't even hear the notes he's playing on the bass. It's just like you have another drummer. It's totally percussive. Just clap, ba da pa ba da ba da. So you hear the attack without actually hearing the notes. But back in this point here, there's this really nice smoothness to his bass sound. I mean, I don't know whether this was, if he was using a P bass on this, or, you know, early on he played a J bass, a jazz bass, that maybe what is on this track, because it is really very different and very clear, very smooth, but great, great tone, great song. You know, it gives you a great sense of what's to come from this band. I mean, I know a lot of people probably think this doesn't really sound like Maiden, but I think that burning ambition is exactly what it sounds like. You know, it's the roots of Maiden. You can hear stuff in that track that you're going to hear developed and further expanded, that it's going to be a core to their sound. It's also interesting that it's the only recording that they put out there featuring Doug Sampson on drums. I played with them for a number of years and had to sort of drop out of the band for health reasons right before doing the first record. You know, he was on the compilation, the Metal for Mothers compilation that we'll talk about, but this was the only thing that sort of made it to a long-term recording that we would be still listening to and talking about all these years later. And Dennis Stratton, the second guitar player who they added, again, right before the recording of the first album, does not appear on this either, because these are the 1979 recording sessions. And so this is Dave Murray. This is when they were a four-piece, and Dave Murray's double-tracking his guitars. So that's a really interesting sound. And Paul, I mean, you got to talk about Paul Di'Anno, lead singer here. He's just in his element. Like, this is when he's at his best in a lot of ways. He's got this great rough vocal on it. And he's like taking something that probably wasn't quite as solid in the demo form, but then when he brings this energy to it, it really becomes fantastic. So Burning Ambition, a fantastic track. Which brings us on to the second single, Sanctuary, backed with Drifter and I've Got the Fire, both live. This was a 7-inch single released on May 23rd, 1980. Did have the two B-sides, and it reached a chart position of 29. I could do an entire episode on Sanctuary. Maybe I will, you know, because, I mean, just the notes I have on this song are like pages long, more or less on two different subjects here. One is that this is a non-album single, which isn't that unique in of itself, but it was on the version of the album that I fell in love with, the version that was released in the United States. And that's a whole topic. And the other issue is that Steve Harris didn't write this song, but he bought the rights off of one of the former guitar players, a guy named Bob Angelo Sawyer. And I have all kinds of thoughts and feelings about that, but I might deal with these issues, you know, sort of in a separate, like a bonus episode or something, because Sanctuary is such a great tune. It brings the entire energy and quality level of that album up by like a tenth or higher. I mean, the whole quality of the album gets better with the addition of Sanctuary. And for me to have to be here saying that my favorite song on the first Iron Maiden album isn't on the first Iron Maiden album, that's just bizarre. It's just weird. Anyway, the first version of the song Sanctuary was one of two songs that Maiden did. The other was Wrathchild, that appeared on the 1980 compilation Metal for Mothers, which I mentioned briefly earlier. They re-recorded it for the single in April 1980 with the lineup for the first album. And it's so good. I just love this song to pieces. I mean, the studio version, there's so much energy to this track. It always, always gets my blood pumping. And I love just about any live version that I've heard of this song. You know, especially when we get to Live After Death and the B-sides for that, those singles, where Dickinson holds on to this one note for like a full minute. Oh, it kills me. So it's a favorite of mine. So sorry to talk about it so long, but it's in my top 20 Maiden songs, even knowing what I know about the songwriting credit. It's doesn't ruin it for me. It's still up there. A lot of people are going to tell you that this is just a filler tune. It's straightforward. And maybe it is a straightforward track, but it's so energetic. It's so simple, but the energy of the players, the vocals, it just takes it to the next level. It really is something very special. So that brings us to the B-sides, and they have two tracks that they recorded live at the Marquee Club in London on April 3rd, 1980. And it's sort of funny about this because the first of the songs, Drifter, was generally their set closer, and I've Got the Fire was generally their set opener. And here on the single, they've put them exactly reversed. Just kind of funny trivia to me. The song was originally called Drifting back in the Gypsy's Kiss days. It was one of the songs that sort of survived from that time. But I knew it as a Killers track. This is actually the closing song on their second studio album, Killers. And that is because, like so many other bands, so many other artists that would play the clubs for years, they're pretty much playing like everything they knew, everything they'd written, everything they had as part of their live set for a long period of time. And then they were able to squeak out almost two complete albums without having to write more than a couple of new songs. It's true of Van Halen and a number of other bands that, you know, it usually takes until like your third album before you run out of the songs that you workshopped live for years and years. And now you have to find out if you can come up with good new songs on a deadline. You know, now is when it's really the test for a band. So not for nothing is the third record considered that make or break album. But this track here, the live version of Drifter from the Marquee, this is by far my favorite version of this song. I love this. I love the version that closes out Killers. And I dislike just about every other version of this song that I've ever heard. And the reason for that? Audience participation. Singer Paul Di'Anno does this yo-yo-yo sort of call and response thing that's just ridiculous. Now, I've heard different accounts over the years that, you know, he was taking the piss out of the police because they had a big single out at the time, Walking on the Moon, where Sting does that silly yo-yo-yo crap. I have a hard time crediting that. I know I've read it from a number of accounts. It's not impossible. It's probably true, but I just have a hard time. I mean, it just sounds like a football chant to me, you know? It doesn't really sound that unique. I've probably heard this song, the Drifter recording from the Marquee in 1980. Probably heard this somewhere on the order of 700 times in my life. That's how much I love it. I still have absolutely no idea what he's saying before he does that whole yo-yo-yo business. He makes some sort of comment to the crowd. And it's like really meaningful to them because they're all like, hey, yeah, they get really excited about whatever he says. But it sounds like complete nonsense. Now, I did read recently that the reason that you can't understand it is it was a studio overdub because it was covering up the fact that Di'Anno's actually calling the crowd a bunch of wankers. And so they sort of overdubbed it. And now it sounds just like gobbledygook. But I don't remember where I read that, and I'm not looking for it again. You know, my interest only goes so far, because this crowd interaction thing is just not working for me. It's fairly awful in this version, too, but in a club in 1980, it feels organic. You know, this is the atmosphere in the club. They're doing everything they can to get people into it, and it mostly works with Paul doing it. It doesn't go on too long. So, I mean, anything's too long for me. Call and response, audience participation, it's always too long. But it's fine. It's all right. You know, I can't stand when bands would extend their songs live. I'd rather they just play another song. But it doesn't ruin it or anything. It just drags out what was, up until that moment, a really tight recording. But that's not the first place I got exposed to Drifter Live. I first heard this on the bootleg that I got this at one of the record shows on a cassette. and it was the Palladium in New York City on June 29th, 1982. This was the Beast on the Road tour, supporting the Number of the Beast album. And the sound quality of this thing's amazing. Really, really tight. Enough so that I'm nearly positive that this was a radio broadcast. I think that they played this thing out. That's where the recordings came from. And this is the first tour with Dickinson singing. And he does the same hackneyed call and response thing. He does the yo, yo, yo business. And I mean, it goes on for like 4 hours. Well, I mean, it didn't go on for four. It literally goes about 10 minutes. And it just completely throws cold water on a very energetic performance. And it's the last song. So it's just sort of, you've had this amazing set. And then there's just this long run out. And I mean, it doesn't ruin it. Nothing can ruin this song for me or ruin it live for me because there's so much energy. There are certain tunes that are just absolutely perfect to close out sets with. And this is one of them. There's so much energy to it. It breathes fire. Always, always gets me going. Always on the workout playlist. Great stuff. Great track. And I mean, can you imagine if you'd seen these guys in the club in 1980? I mean, you would know, no question whatsoever, they're going somewhere. The other B-side off of this is also from that same show, again, at the beginning of the night instead of at the end. And this is a cover that they used to use this as a set opener a lot of the times, a cover of a song by Montrose, Ronnie Montrose's band. And this song, it was actually called I Got the Fire. For some reason, they call it I've Got the Maiden covered it and called it I've Got the Fire. But this appeared on their second album, and that was the last one with Sammy Hagar, is the lead singer of Montrose. And reportedly, Hagar wrote or co-wrote this song, but he didn't get any credit for it. Montrose took all the songwriting credit for it, so we'll never really know. But when I would listen to the first 10 years, you know, early on, because as I say, this was not the first selection in the series that I got, I could not understand their obsession, Iron Maiden's obsession with this song, because they do I've Got the Fire twice as a B-side. They put it out, you know, there's this live one that they put on their second single, but then 3 years later, with a different singer and now being superstars, they recorded it again in the studio as a B-side for the Flight of Icarus single off the Peace of Mind album. And I don't know, I just didn't think it was so great of a song that you had to do it twice. I still don't think that, but it is a good song. It's a solid rock and roll track. And more importantly, it's a really great example of picking a cover that really complements your style. They play it very faithfully. It's more or less exactly like the Montrose recording, but it still sounds like Maiden. It's one of those tunes that Maiden covers. They do this a number of times where you, after you've heard Maiden's version, you sort of always think of it as a Maiden song, even though it quite obviously isn't. It's a cover. But there's some bands that are able to do that with covers. They play them faithfully and yet somehow take ownership of the song. They shift that ownership to themselves. And this is one of them. And two great live tracks. Always great to get the early Maiden live, because they're just a powerhouse you're listening to here. And that they were still playing clubs and theaters at this point is practically amazing. And it would have been really, really something to see. That gives me just a minute to talk about the covers. I'll talk about the cover art for both of these singles. Are gorgeous pieces of art from Derek Riggs. They interestingly sort of bookend the album that comes in between. The LP, the debut album, is a painting that Rod Smallwood found this when he was looking through artist Derek Riggs' portfolio. It was this one painting called Electric Matthew Says Hello. And the guy on there was a punker, punk being all the rage at that point. And said, all right, put some more hair on him there, make him look a little bit more like a metal guy, and you've got Eddie. There you got that album. I honestly have never really cared for the album cover. I know I'm very much in the minority on this, but it just looks kind of underdone to me. It looks like exactly what it is. Something they didn't actually plan, it just sort of came about. And I like the singles that surround that first album more, because it was more intentional. Derek Riggs actually was hired to do these. So the first single came out before the album. Running Free came out before the debut album, so they didn't want to ruin what Eddie was going to look like. They thought that this would be a really striking cover, which of course history has proved that it is, whatever I think, notwithstanding. So they hide him. So the cover of Running Free, you've got this guy who looks pretty much like Steve Harris, I'm sure it is Steve Harris, running down this alleyway away from this strange guy in the shadows, you know, and it's sort of cool that Eddie's got a broken bottle and he's sort of out back there, but you can't see him. You can only see these eyes. So it's a cool piece. I mean, even if it doesn't really make any sense, you know, if you look at it again, you say, well, wait a minute, Eddie doesn't actually have a left arm in this picture. That's kind of weird. But then you see, oh, in the foreground of the image, you actually see this arm reaching in, you know, to get Steve Harris. That's kind of cool. It's so that your view is almost point of view of this killer or whoever it is, except it's a right arm. So I don't know. It doesn't make any real sense. Not to mention the fact that the title of the track is Running Free. And man, this guy doesn't look like he's running free. He looks like he's running from one problem into another. So it doesn't totally make sense, but it's a huge attention grabber, you know, and that's what it was supposed to do. Not quite as much as the sleeve for Sanctuary. I mean, this is the attention grabber. Maiden's following the hard rock playbook here, deliberately going after controversy by having a bloody knife-wielding Eddie standing over the body of then-British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, nicknamed by many the Iron Maiden, because she's caught in the act of tearing down an Iron Maiden poster. So you know, Eddie, of course, wasn't going to stand for that. Their manager, Rod Smallwood, you know, never misses a trick. He got the record label to censor the image, putting a black bar over the PM's eyes, you know, pretending that they were forced to do so. And come on, I mean, the next time that fails to drive press attention will be the first. Because of course it worked. Of course they got the controversy, and you know, the London rags were more than happy to amplify the signal by putting it on there and pretending that it was a serious situation. It's just, it's so predictable, but they'll stop doing it when it stops working, which is never. And it's just funny. I mean, you know, the picture may not be your cup of tea, right? But I gotta say, if you can find the original painting that the single comes from, it's gorgeous. It really is very striking. I mean, it doesn't look totally like the one that came out. It looks like EMI color timed both these covers. They both have this sort of orangish, gritty tone to them, presumably to make them, you know, sort of match together and to somewhat, again, keep the same look as the debut album cover. But it's too bad, because I mean, the Sanctuary painting, which I've seen on Derek Riggs' website, it's really pretty gorgeous. I mean, not Eddie slaying Margaret Thatcher, but the sky is really, really nice with these blacks and blues, and the nighttime sky is really gorgeous. And it looks a lot more like what he would then go to do with the Killers album cover, which is also this grisly scene, but it's just, it looks so good and just much more satisfying than the debut album for me. Oh, and don't worry about the Prime Minister. She gets her revenge on the cover of the next single that we're going to do. So that's it. That's the first 10 years, part one. If you had gotten a hold of this, you would have heard Nico talking for a lot less time than I did. Not as complete, maybe more interesting. But that's what I can tell you about the first two Iron Maiden singles and the first 10 years release that celebrated them 10 years later. I wish that I could give you links to hear all of this stuff, or at least to the original singles, but you're gonna have to hit the racks if you want to find these records. At the time that I recorded this, the Maiden YouTube channel does actually have a lot of stuff up there. It's a lot more than I was aware of. They've got the singles on there when they were promoting the 2015 reissue. They put out these 7 inches on vinyl. I skipped them. I sat out on those because I said, oh, well, those don't have all the B-sides on there. They'll probably reissue the 12 inches, but to date, they still haven't. So I'm kind of kicking myself on that. But, so, you know, they were promoting the fact they were putting these out here. So they actually do have the A-side and B-side in like one video track for pretty much all of these. They don't have Made in Japan. And of course, you're not going to get Nico's Not a Lot of People Know That tracks. But it shouldn't take you too long wandering around YouTube to find unofficial stuff is out there. That'll get you through until the band bows to the pressure created by my cute little podcast and all the fans of my podcast. And they'll re-release this series. But you never know. Next time, first 10 years, part 2, Women in Uniform and the double A-side, Twilight Zone and Wrathchild. Thanks for joining. Cheers.